Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is space anthropologist Savannah Mandel, and we're talking about her book, Ground Control, An Argument for the End of Space Exploration. Savannah, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, Mark. Yeah, it's great, really great to be here.
Now, this book, I can tell you right now, there's a lot of people who are going to not be happy about this book, because space is sort of ingrained that, you know, we got to go to outer space. But you consider this book a call to arms. Tell me why.
Yeah, I mean, I knew going into writing it that the response would be super divided, and it has been. I've received a ton of support, and I've also, you know, and now I have on my contact form in my website a special place for hate mail.
So, now, wait a minute. Do you really get hate mail? Like real hate mail?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I get true, absolute, very mean things written to me in my email inbox all the time. But I also get lots of really, like, loving, supportive emails. So that's been a really cool surprise. But
I can never understand people writing hate mail like that.
Yeah, I mean, I get it in this context a little bit. I mean, I don't get why anyone needs to be mean to anyone else, but I do get why this is a subject that really feels something in so many of us, like feels such strong emotions, mm-hmm. because I think that we are all raised from like a really young age to just to be driven to look up at the stars, to feel something about them, to think about them, to wonder about them. I mean, this is ingrained in our being. So I think it is a natural response to when someone says, hey, what if we didn't send humanity to outer space? To be like, whoa, that's scary. That's intimidating. Like the thought of not having humans in space is a scary thing. Yeah.
But ultimately, the way that you, and we'll talk about this later in the interview, is you write that we need to solve some problems here first, then maybe we could go into space.
Yeah, and that's why I think about this book as a call to arms and use that metaphor, is because there are, I mean, think about what's been happening over this past, you know, weekend with the all the hurricanes and natural disasters. I mean, there are so many issues on Earth that are affecting us here and now that putting money towards space tourism and, you know, exploration for the sake of exploration or a return to the moon purely to say we did it feels a bit too frivolous to me at the moment. And I think we should prioritize these earthly issues before we send humans to outer space. Yeah.
And give me an example of what issues you're talking about.
So specifically, the book talks about, addresses climate change, scarcity. So in other words, like the distribution of resources globally. And then I would say as well, so I kind of round up civil conflict. So just the political unease that is present, very present in our world right now. And the idea of the book, which is very radical, don't get me wrong, is that once we kind of reach a point of stability with several of these issues and learn to manage them, at least, I think management is the key word here, then we can say, okay, now is the time to send humans to outer space, and we won't feel guilty about leaving anybody behind on Earth. Because I think that was what started to worry me the longer I was working in the space industry as an anthropologist, is I started to think about building colonies in space is all fine and dandy, but what do we do about those left behind? You know, how do we figure out
who gets to go?
Who gets to go, and also who gets to stay and why we're going and when we're going and how we're going.
But, I had strong reactions to the book too, but it was much more nuanced. First of all, I really am very scared about the commercialization of space travel. And that's new to me. I'm old enough that I remember Sputnik and all the stuff that came after that. And initially, this started out as a space race with the Soviet Union. But then, when we landed on the moon, that was a huge deal. That was an accomplishment for humanity. At least that's the way that it felt. And then, as you mentioned in the book, there were protests even then about, you know, don't bother sending people to the moon. We have problems here. You know, people can't eat moon rocks. And I understood that. But the problem is, even if you don't go to the moon, that doesn't mean that money's going to go to solving those problems.
Yeah, that is the question that many of my audience members have brought up with me, and I think it's one of the best questions I'm being asked, because it's forcing me to think about this issue in new ways. I love it when my audience members ask me questions, because I'm just like, oh, great point. Like, I hadn't thought about that. And so this idea of, okay, well, how do we ensure that if these resources aren't putting towards human space exploration, that they are distributed in a way that is better for humankind as a whole? I mean,
that's never going to happen, though. I know, the country is so divided as it is right now. I can't believe that we're able to accomplish anything right now. That's why the idea of landing on the moon is, at least we accomplished that. Because I really feel like we're totally not dealing with climate change. And my feeling is, that's going to really kick us in the rear within the next 30 years before we even get around to settling an argument like, yes, let's put all the money towards that. I think it's going to be too late.
Yeah, I mean, I'm concerned, and I agree with you that I think the same thing might happen. I think what pushes people to make radical changes socially is often disaster. So, for example, you know, we've seen laws turn out about electric cars, but only after like climate change has gotten to a point where we've started to see like, okay, if we don't make these changes now, and this is in the EU, right? This is not in America.
Oh yeah.
You know, if we don't make these changes now, we are going to, you know, face disaster in, you know, they say a decade, 20 years, you know, 30 years. And it's sadly often when you reach that point of disaster that suddenly governments around the world start actively, super quickly working towards solution instead of 30 years prior.
And the one of the points that you make in this book that I really, really agree with is, one of the things about some kinds of space explorations, especially things like the Elon Musk and stuff like that, is, yeah, let's go build a colony on Mars because everything's going to hell on Earth. So let's go to another place and not solve the problems here.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I started thinking about a lot when I was writing this was this idea of maintenance and how, like, when had we let go of that? You know, at what point have we stopped thinking we should fix what we had broken before moving on? And it's a tough choice to make as an adult. Like, I think as an adult, I want to go off and buy the shiny new, you know, car. My car is having trouble right now, right? I want to buy a new car so badly instead of paying for all these repairs, but it makes a lot of sense for me to just repair my car.
Right, right.
Because it's paid off, and it's honestly a reliable car, repairs aside, you know, and it will last me another 100,000 miles, 150. And so, you know, we make these tough decisions, and one of those tough decisions we're facing is, do we put all of our effort, all of our resources into maintaining planet Earth, or do we leave it and focus on the solution elsewhere?
I think one of the central problems to that solution, which I agree with, it would be great if we did that, is that you've got a number of world powers that are not on board with this. When I think of China, Russia, and the United States, I just don't see how they're even going to agree on anything right now. It'll be, by the time they agree on it, it'll already be past the tipping point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the problems the book talks about a little bit, but doesn't go into depth about. Other books have gone into greater depth about this, is how do you ensure that, like, one, you're not only trying to get a bunch of different administrations to agree on something, but that over multiple generations, they will continue to agree on that as administrations change. And I think that's where you need something like a multinational governing body to deal with these truly global issues. That's like the United Nations, but it's thinking for the future. And so, you know, what does that look like? How does it get instituted? How does it regulate? How does it ensure that, you know, something like climate change is managed, no matter who is in charge in America or who is in charge in Finland or China or Russia, right? Like,
well, I think one of the interesting things is at least you put it out there. Does that make sense?
That I put it out there?
In other words, you're suggesting it. And it's an idea that people need to think about, maybe, hopefully, to institute something like that. I just think things are going to happen way too fast for us to even think logically about this. You know, you look at the situation in the Middle East, the solutions to that are we know what needs to be done. A simple ceasefire we can't even agree on.
Yeah.
And so something as groundbreaking as getting everybody on board for climate change just seems complete. I mean, I guess I'm at that age where I have no faith in the general population.
No, you're right. I mean, that's why it's like, but I think the first step, like you said, is to like
get it out there,
start getting the word out there and getting more people involved in such a conversation from diverse perspectives. And when I say diverse, I don't mean just in demographics. I do mean from different fields. You know, I think the one angle that's unique about this book is I am an anthropologist working from a background of, you know, cultural studies, examining space from that lens, space sciences, you know, and it helps us, I think, see the gaps in our knowledge about space science when you have people from other fields coming in and working in there.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is space anthropologist Savannah Mandel, and we're talking about her book, Ground Control, An Argument for the End of Space Exploration. Savannah, I have to ask you, and you explain this in the book, about becoming a space anthropologist. There wasn't even a position like that when you started, right? Or was there? Were there other previous space anthropologists?
Yes and no. So when I graduated with my BA in anthropology in 2016, you really just had a couple of dozen people working in space anthropology or anthropologists who were doing research on outer space at that time period. And they weren't well known. I mean,
were they doing the kind of things that you were doing, like really looking at who benefits from these projects?
I would say their work was ethically minded, but not quite as focused on ethics. So you had people like Janet Vertesi, who had done work on the Spirit and Opportunity rovers when they were being created. And she wasn't really thinking about morals or ethics. She was thinking about, you know, how we embody rovers as we create them and how humanhood is like put on other planets through these mechanical objects. And then you had people whose work is, I think, a little bit more focused on that like political side. So someone examined maps of Mars and looked at how they were framed in a democratic and dynamic light based on what knowledge is placed on these maps on Google Earth. And that anthropologist did work with the creators of those Google Earth maps who were mapping Mars at that time period when it was happening. So, I mean, the work did exist, but I didn't know it existed, and neither did many of my professors. I still have tenured track, like, people reach out to me all the time and say, hey, I had no idea that anthropologists were doing this work on space. This is so cool. Like, I want to know more. Send me the literature.
Cool.
And I think it's still not a huge, it isn't a huge field at all. It's a subfield, you know, but it's becoming more well-known and becoming better recognized.
A lot of this for you, you went through sort of a sea change of attitude towards space exploration, and it seemed to have begun at Spaceport America, where you were doing research.
Yeah, I think for me,
a lot of people have not even heard of that place. Can you explain that, what it is?
Yeah. So a spaceport in general is like an airport for spaceships. You know how an airport has like Delta Airlines and United Airlines? Well, a spaceport has companies like Boeing and Up Aerospace that rent out basically parts of it to utilize whatever they need, the runway or other areas. And so when I did find a field, say, as an anthropologist, I went out to Spaceport America in New Mexico. It's in the middle of the desert. It was a very cool experience. It was very cool. I mean, at this point in time, to give you guys context, I love space. I grew up loving space travel.
And you write that you still want to go into space.
I mean, yeah, it's like if I got an offer to go to space, it would be so hard to say no, but I would because I, you know, I think it's ethically wrong, but I'd be over here nerding out about it, you know? Like, the passion is still there and was absolutely there. And when I went out to do my field work as an anthropologist, I didn't question that space was progress. Like, that narrative, that rhetoric was so intense within me, and it was intense, an intense part of everyone who worked there and why they were doing their work, is I just thought space travel is progress. But the more I was out at Spaceport America, and then eventually through my work in policy in D.C., and just being in Washington, D.C., and the space industry there, I was exposed to, I guess you could say, like, my rose-colored glasses got cracks in them, right? And I started seeing flaws in this narrative. I started collecting evidence, too, that just made me question things. So I use this example a lot, but, for example, I would have, like, you know, a list of celebrities that were going to go on Virgin Galactic flights on one side of my notes, and I had on the other side a list of poverty statistics for the surrounding counties. Or, you know, like, I had all these old articles that talked about how the spaceport was meant to bring economic prosperity to the area, and then, you know, fraud allegations against it, and the fact that they were really kind of importing labor from other states and from Albuquerque and Las Cruces rather than hiring people from the counties that were paying with their taxpayer money for the spaceport. And so I, at that point in time, and when I finished my fieldwork in 2018, I was just asking questions. I was like, well, what does that mean? Like, what are the motivations for this work? What say are these people getting in this conversation? You know, who is being left behind when you guys do want to go to these colonies? Like, I was just asking questions the same way I think, like, a five-year-old would ask questions about their parents, you know, when they're asking questions about space. But then when I went to D.C., I went to Washington, D.C. during the same time that the Space Force was being created, and space was being framed in, like, a hyper-militarized light.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
Very, like, the rhetoric being used was very imperial. It was very colonial. And I was trained as an anthropologist to think about those things when I saw them. And I started asking, you know, what are the damages being done about framing space in a warfighting light, which was as like framing the space environment as a warfighting zone, which is what representatives in Congress were explicitly trying to do. And gradually, the more I was exposed and the more evidence I gained, I started thinking, like, is it right? And it felt very taboo. It felt very taboo to be thinking these thoughts. I didn't know who to talk to about them. I didn't know how to communicate them. I felt like I couldn't say them out loud. Because I feel like when you talk negatively about space exploration, you are seen like a crazy person. And because so many people attach space exploration blindly without questioning it to progress. But that progress doesn't have to look that way. I mean, progress can be tied to maintenance and earthly things and the care of our planet, and restoration and caretaking, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm. But the problem, again, is the fact that we live on a political planet. And part of the things, not that I agree with it at all, is that the fear that some of the other political players are going to start using space for military reasons, even though we have treaties that you're supposedly not going to happen. But it looks like it's going to be. And I don't know what you do with that. I mean, I don't want China or Russia to start shooting down satellites that are like communication satellites and stuff like that. So, you know, there are those kinds of realities too. However,
yeah.
That's only part of the story. And so, you know, this idea that you would bring in more people on a panel to discuss, do we really need to do this? What's a better way to do this that more people can be involved in? I mean, that's the question you ask always throughout the book, is who benefits from these programs?
And I think that when we think about the context of, okay, if we don't go, if we don't, like, if we don't establish ourselves as a military superior in this environment, someone else will, is perhaps a flawed way of thinking, because I just wonder if that idea is a little bit bound up in America's, like, otherwise, obsession with military superiority. But then we can look back to the Cold War, Rich, where if America hadn't gone to space, what would have happened? I mean, I think it's tough to say, because Russia probably would have gone to space first. Would they have? We don't know. Would have a Cold War have broken up? Would there be nukes in space? There are consequences to inaction, so to speak. But I think we should also think about the ways, like, okay, what other ways can America become superior if we don't go to space and become scientific and technologically superior in other parts of our, in other industries?
But this is where it all gets wrapped up in capitalist systems. And the problem is right now, for instance, things like AI are running away with everything that we're doing. And people can hardly put on the brakes on AI, even though everybody has suggested concerns about it, both economic and the idea it could be an existential threat. But that stuff is just running away from us. It really seems that we're at a point in global politics and global sort of interests that it's really tough to put the brakes on anything at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think with both of these topics, AI and space exploration,
See them as very similar and intertwined.
Yeah, I think the key comes down to regulation, how we're regulating, who is regulating, and, how effective the regulation is over a long period of time. I think both industries are emerging so rapidly, and with something new is happening every day, and the commercial industry is being regulated. I mean, we have new commercial space laws popping up all the time. I think the fear with space is, what happens if one of those laws are broken? There's no cops in space.
There's no space cops. We have these treaties. We have these treaties, which you write about extensively in the book. But you're right. I mean, who's going to enforce the treaty, and what are you going to do?
Yeah, we have treaties. I mean, we have even more than that. We have all these bills and acts that have come out since then too. But I think the fear is just how easy it would be to break those laws, and the fact that a lot of the treaties kind of now, I don't know what you would say, like. Don't stand up in regards to some of the other legislation that's been made. So, you either need a complete revision or some sort of new – it's complicated. But either way, I do think in regards to AI and space that there is this issue surrounding regulation and standards, and how do you regulate a commercial space industry when it is not federal. And that is a new part of the landscape,
right.
That is constantly being navigated.
I don't even know if it's being navigated. I think people are just making decisions on their own. I think once you get to commercial space thing, when you talk about asteroid mining, which you do in the book, and all these other programs that are commercializing space, I think people are just, and they have the money to do this, they're just acting in their own interests.
Yeah, I mean, asteroid mining is a wonderful case study. I'm doing my whole dissertation on space mining, and I'm learning all about its history right now. And I think... I mean, asteroid mining is the perfect example of an industry founded on capitalism, and it is I've learned asteroid mining emerged out of, the asteroid mining boom emerged out of the Silicon Valley boom, and many of those asteroid mining companies that emerged in the 2010s. Many don't exist anymore, but they stemmed from their founders. Were people who created other Silicon Valley companies.
Huh.
And
are they looking for minerals that are key to materials used in computers? Is that the promise of asteroid mining, is that they're going to be able to get some of these precious metals that are used in different elements within computers and AI that are becoming scarce here in the Earth?
No, most of them just wanted to mine asteroids to truly sell them, like for commercial purposes.
Oh, to sell the asteroids.
Sell the minerals. So they did want to get some of the minerals that were crucial to computer processes and like medical technologies, but they wanted to get them as a company so they could make money off of selling them, not to help planet Earth. But I will say this, that you did have, like, NASA has some mining interest in space mining that is more focused on, I mean, they frame it that it's not focused on selling those objects for a commercial market. It is focused on analysis of the asteroid, and it's focused on mining the minerals to, you know, mining the asteroids to understand their, it's more like scientifically oriented.
It's to
oriented
find out their asteroids. Composition, to find out, and that'll lead to what their origins are, which will give us a better understanding of the origins of the universe.
Yeah.
Plus the fact there, I think the Earth getting hit by an asteroid is actually a real situation. And that's one thing where I can say anything that you want to do in space that'll teach us how to ward off an asteroid hit would be worthwhile.
I mean, that's true. It's interesting how I expected to see more overlap throughout this research project in, like, these companies doing work that has to do with asteroid protection.
Yeah,
but it wasn't there. Really is not a lot of overlap. God.
That
does exist.
Okay.
But well, the two industries are not overlapped.
We could talk, we got to end because we're completely out of time. We could talk about your book for hours. My guest tonight is space anthropologist Savannah Mandel, and we've been talking about her book, Ground Control, An Argument for the End of Space Exploration. Savannah, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me so much. Everyone is welcome to reach out to me and contact me via my website. Send me their love mail and hate mail.
You're listening to WICN. Don't send hate mail. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.